You're listening to the Champions Rugby Show with me, Martin Hindley. We're heading stateside now to speak to a man who helped Bath Rugby to the greatest moment in their history.
The referee checks his watch. Bath are the European champions. That has to be one of the most dramatic rugby matches of all time.
This former number eight played in Bath's brilliant European Cup triumph in 1998, the win that halted the juggernaut of the French at the start of the tournament's history. He played in two Rugby World Cups for the USA, and now he's a television personality, as well as a huge advocate for rugby in the United States, covering the Heineken Champions Cup, among other things, for NBC Sports. Joining me today, an absolute pleasure to say, is Dan Lyle. Dan, how are you getting on without any live sport right now? It must be very frustrating for you.
Yeah, I am completely desperate. I imagine like everybody else. And thanks for that intro. And it's wonderful to relive so many great memories.
You have so many irons in the rugby fire, and you have had ever since your career ended, really. Have you really had the chance to go back and to appreciate the things that you achieved in your playing career?
Yeah, well, I suppose I'm very, very lucky. My wife is from Bath, so I have connections there now forever, you know, with our family and aunties and uncles and cousins and grannies and everybody in between. So my three sons are dual nationality, and you know, I guess my job is to make sure that when they turn 18 or 21, when they're of age to jump out into the world, that if they so blessed to play and have the talent to play, that that England isn't the easy choice. Maybe that the USA is also competing. You know, so I've got about a decade before that happens.
Well, let's take you back to the start of your rugby career now. You were a bit of a latecomer to the sport, weren't you? I mean, can you explain how it came about and how your career was really jolted into action?
Yeah, I suppose I was like most Americans, where I grew up playing every sport under the sun, and soccer and basketball were my two biggest sports that I played till I was 18. And I actually came late to American football from an American perspective, kind of in high school, but I was, you know, larger than most, taller than most. And so football kind of became an easier sport for me. And I went on to play at university, and then kept growing, kept developing at university, and had an opportunity to play in the NFL out of college, and had some trials with the Washington Redskins. And when I did not make the team out of college, I had a first cousin playing rugby for the Washington Rugby Club in Washington, D.C. And he said, why don't you come out and run around with us? And that was at the time where really you had to play pickup basketball and play rugby and play sport in order to stay fit. And so I did that and really saw rugby as a sport that was every sport that I had grown up playing rolled into one.
What was the reception like when you came to join Bath? I read an article not too long ago with Jeremy Guscott having said, you know, it changed a few preconceived ideas that America and rugby didn't quite go together. Did it cause a stir? And what was the reaction of people in Bath when you first pulled on the jersey?
Well, I think, of course, like most people, I came over on a not so great contract, kind of a temporary contract. You know, this was the first year of professionalism, so probably everybody's contract was a little bit different than they are now. And it was really more of a trial meets, you know, Bath coming into the age of professionalism. And so I had the opportunity to be the first pro for America, or the first pro almost in Bath, you know, where in a sense that I had come through the university system and into the professional environment over here. So I knew what it was like to play, to train, to watch video, to do all the things that you have to do in order to become a pro. What I didn't know is all the nuances of the game, to the intricacies and to the detail and kind of the secondhand nature of rugby that was there. But I had the instincts of soccer and basketball and football and other sports there. So all of that kind of came together, and I really just hit the ground running. And that was a credit to two different organizations. One was the players that were there that said, hey, if you can play. And I think that was the message that I found from Bath from day one from the players was, hey, if you can play, you're in the team. And I think the eclecticness of and success of all the years of Bath proved that out. And the second one was the fans. That, you know, there wasn't some curmudgeonly dialogue about, hey, this American, why is he in the team versus this guy and so forth. It was very merit-based with the fans as well. So I really hit an environment, both, you know, on a training environment and playing environment and from the fans that I could only have wished for.
And that, let's remember, was a Bath side that was doing incredibly well domestically and continued to do so throughout that middle section of the 90s. Did that make it, to some extent, even still daunting, despite those two pillars that you said were supportive? Was it still daunting to come into that side and to have to be at such a high level straight away?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I'm a student of history. That was one of my majors at university. And so coming into a beautiful Roman 2000-year-old city, Georgian, you know, all of those things that are wonderful about Bath from a heritage perspective, and then having the history of this great rugby club, you know, it felt comfortable to me. It felt that I was part of that, even though I had not been part of any of that success up to that point. So, I really embraced the history on both from a city perspective as well as from rugby perspective, and quickly learned, you know, the history of how good we had become. And 1865 is from the founding, and that was kind of the end of the American Civil War. And so you kind of have this idea in your head of how brilliant and old, but how well the club had done for so many years.
Andy Nicol on the Champions Rugby Show recently was sort of speaking about that quarterfinal against Cardiff in Bath's first ever season in the Heineken Cup being one of the motivations to go on and go a few steps better the season after. At the start of that 97-98 season, did you feel that there was something special that group of players could achieve that would even go steps further than you had done domestically?
Yeah, I think a lot of people might not realize how many good quality coaches and players that surrounded the team. And for me, you know, the Brian Ashtons, the Clive Woodwards, you know, let alone the John Halls and the Randy Robinsons and the Jonathan Cullard, who was a player coach and became the coach. These were all players that had either come through the Bath system or were very offensive, putting the ball through your hands oriented. And that was the style of game that I really adapted to and really played well at. So we had a lot of confidence just in ourselves, just in playing the game. And certainly, you know, the balance of the game is forwards and backs, but it almost felt like we, every time we walked out on the field, we felt that we could win the game. There was never a lack of confidence, and maybe that bravado at times can outstrip injuries or the length of the season or the weather and things like that. So, yeah, I think we were a very confident side because of the way that we were coached and the way that we were assembled.
Then, as now, no such thing as an easy game in the European Cup. You were drawn with Scottish Borders, a very strong Pontypridd side, and I guess the strongest of them all in Brive in the pool stage, who, of course, at that point were the European champions, having destroyed Leicester in Cardiff in the final the previous season. Was there a sense of momentum as you built through the tournament and worked towards that quarterfinal match against Cardiff?
Yeah, you know, I think that you reflect on, you know, what those games meant at the time. And I think that, you know, they all felt a step ahead of the Premiership, you know, and we had only played, you know, I'd only played the season before, you know, so, and then that season. So, you know, having 20, 30 games in my bag, you know, from a Bath perspective in the Premiership, but you could naturally feel that the Heineken Cup for the team, for the fans, you know, I think there was a sense of probably destiny for Bath itself, you know, and that it had been considered one of the best teams in the world, let alone Europe. And so it took on a special meaning when we got to play in the Heineken Cup. And you know, those games just had that much more value, you know, in the training a week as you walked around town, just a lot of feel-good vibes that can lead to a better momentum each week.
So Brive play to lose in one of the semi-finals, and you get to play Poe at the Rec. Tell us what a boost it was to you and to that group of players to be in front of those fans in a place that very quickly became incredibly close to your heart.
As I said, it never felt like we were going to lose a game. Certainly, having Poe at home and the wreck, you know, it's hard to really tell people what a comfortable feeling feels like when you're competing against the best, right? But the confidence that I think we had in each other and the comfort level that we had at playing at the wreck, we never felt like we were going to lose that game. You know, it was about a matter of how we were going to perform and, you know, one eye on being able to play either, you know, Breve or Toulouse in the next, you know, in the final. But knowing how far we had come and kind of that destiny dialogue that was kind of intertwined in our season. You know, yeah, it was I think 20-14 might have been the score of that game. So it wasn't like we, you know, it was there for Poe, of course, you know, but it just felt like we were always going to, you know, get to the final.
Before the final, the team flew out to, I think it was Saint-Emilion, to prepare 2 or 3 days in advance. How important was that preparation time in getting you mentally right for a final, which I suppose was something like an away game in Bordeaux?
Well, I think that progression through the season and through the playoffs, and certainly we weren't waiting all spring to do that as they do now, which I think probably is, maybe it's harder, maybe it's not, but from the sense that we had this end of January date and it was coming, so we could prepare for it. But it certainly felt as that was a full international. You did all of the things that you do when you play an international. You all the preparation, all, you know, you cloister together, you go through all the walkthroughs, the preps. You have those great moments and those awkward moments when you're away. And look, the setting in Bordeaux, Saint-Emilion, you know, the fans, the press, you know, the first, you know, British team. All of those things just made it feel not just special for ourselves and for the fans, but, you know, as a full international.
I think I can say this safely to a former number eight, but you always seem to hear about star-studded back lines and maybe less about the people doing the hard work in the pack. How pleasing was it for you not only to have won the European Cup in the manner that you did and in such a dramatic fashion, but with all of the forwards playing such a significant contribution? And what was the key to that?
Isn't it wonderful to look back on a game like that, that was so close and of such magnitude, and remember moments that each player had, you know? And I think that each player on that team can each take a moment, but, you know, the holding out of the line for the front row, the amount of tackles and rucks hit by our second row and Ollie and Martin, and, you know, just the graft of Nathan and Richard Webster, you know, in the back row with me, Hoots, you know, just playing, you know, just such a steady hand, you know, a who's who in our back line that each had moments, a tap tackle by Yian Evans, a penalty by Addy, obviously all the points by JC, you know, selected over Matt Perry.
So the tables turn, and Bob now, heartened by this passage of play, Lyle goes the number eight. Nickel the captain. Chance to move it wide. Guskin, must be a try. Callard! John Callard, the man who was preferred to the current England fullback, Matt Perry.
You know, Caddy is, you know, one of my favorite players that I've ever played with. Just, and I think most people that play with him can say that, you know, in a sense that he just could do so much. And Phil, you know, to Glanville, you know, former captain, allowing Andy to do his game, but also being there in the back line to marshal them. And then one of the best ever in Jerry, you know, and Guskett, you know, it was remarkable just to be around those guys and really share that moment with them. But, you know, it was wonderful to have that level of talent, and that just added to the confidence.
Now, what can Bob do? They have to resist this final brief challenge. They're going for the drop. No! Has got a hand on it. The referee checks his watch. Bath are the European champions. That has to be one of the most dramatic rugby matches of all time. The Bath players have gone delirious.
What do you remember about the celebrations, not only of being European champions that night in Bordeaux, but in beating the European champions to do it? There's surely no better way. How did you celebrate as a group?
Well, I think it's funny because most of the, not to say that there was a ton of pictures back then. I mean, it was obviously still photography and not a lot of the what we have today and all of that. But in typical fashion, as the American in the group, I was pulled out for doping afterwards, the only guy, you know. And of course I had not hydrated very well apparently, so I missed most of the pictures in the locker room, most of the post game, a lot of the stuff where they go. They actually left me there at the stadium to go to the official post match function. But there is a silver lining, and I wasn't married at the time, and I wasn't dating any at the time. I hitched a lift to the post match function with all of the Heineken Cup ladies that were there promoting Heineken, you know, officially. So I was in the van with the Heineken Cup girls to get to the official function. So that my first, and then afterwards it blew up, right, from the sense of we had some quiet moments as a team, and then we had a night to remember.
What waves did that make back in the US? Did it change the way that you were recognized as a sportsman, adding to the profile that you already had as an international?
Well, I suppose, you know, I'm very lucky in a lot of senses around my choice. I have two contracts as part of my den or an office, and one is the Minnesota Vikings contract and one is the Bath contract, where I had in 1996 the opportunity to go with the Vikings and one to go with Bath, and I chose Bath. And you know, not only do I have my wife and my children, and that decision that rests on its own, but I have this global experience and this kind of level of pioneering that a lot of people labeled it me with. But I was a lucky one in this conversation, and I've had a lot of opportunities and a lot of things that have come my way because I was, you know, one of the first to do all of this. And certainly the Heineken Cup and the championship that we won, you know, just is not just symbolic from the sense of being able to do something first and have success, but something that I take immense pride in, and doing it, something that you can only do with the team.
The success story of this amazing club, it's never ending, but this is their biggest ever prize, and they become the first team to wrestle the Heineken European Cup away from France for the European champions.
You've since been part of the exponential growth in rugby in the United States, and not only of rugby, but also in the exposure to what is now the Heineken Champions Cup, in your work with NBC Sports, network showing of the Heineken Champions Cup final in Newcastle last year. How do you enjoy that role and taking through your experience to give the viewers in America the view on what is a very special tournament to you?
You know, I suppose, you know, as history tells, that, you know, that rugby came from soccer, you know, and ran from there. The Premier League had penetrated the U.S. market by way of NBC and that morning time slot for live television, which is what everybody gets up for. It's still, you know, no matter what television programs you watch, you know, live sport trumps everything. And getting something for rugby in the United States that could be regular television, that was widely available, you know, and of high quality, you know, I kind of stumbled into this, you know, over a decade ago, that this was, that was the need. And rugby getting into the Olympics brought NBC to the table, you know, and were able to negotiate as part of our sevens partnership. But really then the Premier League allowed the Premiership to step up and be there. And it was always the aspiration of NBC really to have a multinational competition on top of the Premiership. The Heineken Cup and the Six Nations became available within quick succession. And based upon, you know, that live television audience, that morning time zones for people, it was, they just leapt at it. And I was just lucky to be there to help guide that process, and had been such a cherished part of my past. It was just a great environment to and property to bring to the table.
How important is that access for American audiences to the highest level of rugby when it comes to developing participation in the sport, and I guess the whole portfolio of rugby in the United States?
It's significant. You have to educate, right? You know, this sport that is authentic in America, that's got 3,000 clubs, 1,000 universities, you know, but it's been an amateur. It's what everybody thought of rugby in a lot of ways. you know, pre-professionalism or maybe a decade before that. And that's what rugby looks like in America. It's played in every metropolitan area, but it wasn't, it's not exposed. So decision makers, moms and dads and athletic directors and parks and recs departments and people that allow access to sport, it was never there. You had to literally take your child to a bar to watch rugby. So getting rugby on mainstream, not just on mainstream television, but in front of huge audiences on one of the main broadcasters in NBC Sports was a game changer for the sport. It still needs to be complemented by the right grassroots strategies, the right, you know, national team high performance strategies, you know, and a good professional league, which is emerging here in America. Those are all the underpinnings. But without that regular content strategy, and you can see high quality, the best of the best, almost appointment television, where you can say to that mom, "Hey, rugby is on Saturday and Sunday mornings and Friday afternoons at this time, you know, on these channels. You know, go and watch it, and you'll actually, you know, fall in love with it." It's you're chasing your tail, you know, without having that little exposure.
In 2016 and 2017, Chris Wiles joined you on the roll of honor as an American to have lifted the trophy when he did so with Saracens in Lyon and in Edinburgh. How important is it also, I guess, to have regular role models as well for those players who are just dipping their toes into the game or just wondering why they really should be interested?
Well, I think, you know, Chris is, you know, a wonderful ambassador for the game and, you know, is doing some great things, you know, post-playing as well. And, you know, it's always funny because when Chris would come on and we would broadcast from NBC headquarters in Stamford, Connecticut, you know, Chris was born in Stamford, Connecticut. So it was the go-to line for all of us broadcasters at the time. You know, it was like Chris Wiles from Stamford, Connecticut, as we come, you know, it was a very funny, very American, obviously, in that regard. But the exposure of Americans playing at the top of their game, you know, Titi Lemesatelli, Joe Tefate, you know, the current models, you know, Bryce Campbell in London Irish, you know, others that have penetrated that, you know, obviously Blaine Scully just retiring, having been at Leicester and Cardiff. It shows, it's a proof point for the game that they can A, earn those contracts, B, play well and excel. And those things are also, you know, part and parcel to, if you didn't have the exposure, if you didn't have the content on television, you wouldn't be able to see those people and you wouldn't be able to, you know, really create that next generation. And you need the best of the best playing at the highest level that you can. And that is in Europe and to a certain degree in the Southern Hemisphere. And then also you need a great domestic league, you know, for things to be successful. So we're now at that place. It's taken the better part of two decades to get there. Now it's about underpinning those things, enforcing them, and getting just more, you know, Chris's, you know, out there.
We're really enjoying using this period to look back at such nostalgic moments as that success that you had in the third Heineken Cup and the final in Bordeaux. I guess that everything else that you achieved, the things that you're working on now, what would you want to be your rugby legacy?
Yeah, I think the legacy for me is, you know, I had a choice to play on for a couple of years. I had a choice to probably become a coach, get on the technical side and things like that. I couldn't imagine coaching people like myself, you know, so I, the administrative side of things, you know, I was one of the original members of the Players Association and worked, you know, 5 or 6 years within that organization. I really just found, that the administrative side of things, the development side of things, you know, I already knew the value of a tackle. You know, it was really about establishing what the value of a ticket was, what the other side of the coin looked like. We have all these natural resources in America for sports and athletes and facilities and corporates and broadcasts. It was really trying to unlock the American market. So as this is a never-ending story, there's never a finish line in sport. But what I get up every day to do is to really advance the game here in the United States and really get some traction so that it becomes very sustainable and it's returning for itself, but it's also returning for the rest of the world. This is a market, going back to soccer, that returns a significant amount of money and perspective back to the rest of the world. So unlocking the game here and making America a bigger part of the global game is it's not an easy task, but it's a satisfying one.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing how you manage to progress everything on the far side of the pond, Dan. Congratulations on what you achieved in the Heineken Cup on the field, and we're looking forward to hearing plenty more of it as you look at the Heineken Champions Cup in your position with NBC Sports. But thank you so much for sharing your recollections and your time, and the very best to you for the ongoing project.
Thanks a lot for wonderful memories.
Great to speak to the former Bath number 8 and 1998 Heineken Champions Cup winner there, Dan Lyle. Some terrific recollections, not just of that day in Bordeaux when Bath became the first British club to win the Heineken Cup, but also on his career as a player and his post-career working so much in the development of our sport in the United States of America. Please subscribe, rate and review our Champions Rugby Show podcast. It's been a pleasure to have your company. And we've got another legend of European rugby coming up shortly to tell you their unique take on a quarter of a century of Heineken Champions Cup history. But for now, from me and all the team, it's goodbye.